Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, September 15th. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Copyright Forum today, and joining us to answer your questions about protecting your writing, your music, your art are Paul Rapp, Polly Law, and Bill Westwood. So if you have a question about copyright law, fair use, what's in the public domain, perhaps, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Polly, Paul, Bill, your intellectual property questions, they're coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Copyright Forum today, we have assembled our usual great panel to answer your questions. Polly Law is a past president of the Graphic Artists Guild, an organization focused on the rights of artists. She is a designer, illustrator, and artist whose works are in numerous private collections and is represented by galleries in Rhinebeck, New York, along with Provincetown and Nantucket, Massachusetts. Bill Westwood is one of the country's leading medical illustrators, so if you got a spleen you want a picture drawn of, he's all over it. A professional member and past president of the Association of Medical Illustrators, Paul Rapp is an intellectual property lawyer and writer. He represents musicians, writers, fine artists, and businesses involved in the creative economy. He's a frequent lecturer, and you'll hear him lecturing very soon. The number to call if you have a question is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Let's start with the person who is remote, and that's Paul Rapp. You're in another country. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing fine. Bonjour, my friend.
Oh, c'est bon. Nice. Oh. So you're up in Montreal, eh?
I'm a boot in Montreal, eh?
Well, that's great. You having fun up there?
Have I what?
Are you having fun up there?
I'm having a blast. We were in Quebec City last night, and now we're in Montreal, and there's a truncated version of the Montreal Jazz Festival going on. And so we'll be checking that out tonight and tomorrow.
So it's truncated. So like trombone shorty and things like that. Polly Law, welcome back to the show. Great to have
Thanks.
You here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Bill Westwood, also you are here. I'm sorry to take a shot about drawing spleens. How many spleens have you drawn in your time?
I have no idea.
A lot, though, right?
A lot.
And how many times have you sued someone over a picture of a spleen?
We're not going to go there.
Oh, really? Well, panel, this crossed the wire, and I guess Paul is already on this and sent this to you. I just picked it up before the show. A U.S. Copyright Office suggests Congress pass new laws to protect artists from state infringement, known as, I believe, sovereign immunity. And once I said those words, Bill Westwood, eyes rolled back in his head. I guess you've had some issues with sovereign immunity.
Yeah, I had about 10 years ago, I had a piece of art that was infringed by a medical university down in the South, and I had somebody look into it, and we got a letter right back from their attorney and said, go pound sand. We have sovereign immunity under the 11th Amendment. You can't sue us. We can basically, she didn't say this, but the essence is they can basically rip you off any way they want to, and you have no recourse.
And Polly, we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. This to me, and I'm not a copyright attorney. We'll get to Paul Rapp in a minute.
Neither am I.
But you're an artist, and it seems to me to be hugely unfair.
Well, yeah, it goes even further than that. If you are an art student at a art school, of course, technically any of the work that you do on assignment for that school, the school owns the rights to. So it extends even into that.
Right. Whether you've agreed to that.
Yeah.
And while technically copyright is supposed to only be transferred in writing, it doesn't seem to matter under those circumstances.
Yeah.
Paul Rapp, are you optimistic that Congress will pass a law and change these rules?
I'm not optimistic about Congress doing anything, but I hope they do, because it's egregious, you know, that the state can just go. And, you know, I mean, the whole 11th Amendment says and in sovereign immunity, the state can't be sued unless it agrees to be sued. And you know,
what state is going to agree to be sued?
Yeah, they say, yeah, go ahead and sue us. And you know, and that gives them license to just rip off artists left and right. And it's kind of disgusting.
Well, plus, I mean, if this was Disney, you know, complaining about sovereign immunity, the Congress would be right on it. But the fact that it's affecting individual artists, nah.
Would a state be bold enough to actually, you know, take a picture of Mickey Mouse and use it in their college advertising? I mean, would they even dare, Paul?
I would love to see that, because I would love to see Disney, lead the charge against this kind of abusive behavior. But, you know, probably most states, you know, are too smart to or too afraid, you know, to rip off Disney. And they're very comfortable ripping off small companies and individual artists.
Bill Westwood, if you don't mind me asking, I assume that the result of the whole thing with the University of Texas did not work in your favor.
No, didn't work in my favor at all. I basically did a quick search. At that time, I didn't know what the 11th Amendment was. I didn't understand sovereign immunity. I was a bit shocked. Since then, there have been a number of cases. The most recent one was the Blackbeard case down in North Carolina, where this photographer had all of these this footage and these photographs of a sunken ship, a Blackbeard ship. And North Carolina swooped in and said, we're going to take all this away from you, basically. Paul can correct me if I got a little bit of this wrong. But we're going to take all this intellectual property away from you under sovereign immunity. It belongs to the state of North Carolina. That was really one of the cases that I think seemed to have spurred the Copyright Office to begin looking into this a little bit more in detail.
Paul, you want to add anything about that case?
No, I agree with Bill 100%. And if that created the tipping point, then great.
All right.
Well, let's get rid of this, you know, ridiculous shenanigans that states are just dumping on people.
Do you think that the state should be given a special category where they would like pay a reduced rate? They'd still have to pay something, but they'd still have to buy a license of some sort.
I don't think so. I mean, they, you know, if they buy in bulk, then they can get a discount, just like how they buy cars and trucks and anything else. But I don't see any reason why they should get preferential treatment.
It's the Copyright Forum on WAMC. If you have a question about copyright, the public domain, fair use, etc., we have Paul Rapp here, Bill Westwood, and Polly Law to answer your questions. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Here's one that came in via email from one of our own here at WAMC, who writes, NFTs, non-fungible tokens, being all the rage. Oh, now everybody's already sighing. Does copyright law apply to photos or music samples used in their creation, or does fair use come into play since most NFTs are produced in limited number and many are one of a kind?
I think this is still up in the air. NFTs are so new, but there have been a number of articles written that warn artists and other creators about the dangers of NFTs. The part of the problem is an NFT is based upon a digital image of whatever it is that's being protected. And given things digital, that would be pretty easy to reproduce and go out and sell again. And then you've got, in theory, the difficulty of trying to prove that it actually belonged to you, although the claim is that you can always prove this, but I have my doubts. There were some other technical aspects of it that I don't recall right off the bat.
But it does. Yeah. It does. Oh, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question was, what about sampling and using other people's stuff in your NFT? And I don't see any reason, and I haven't studied NFTs, I haven't read much about them, I haven't had a client ask me to do it, and I hope I don't, because they kind of creep me out. But I don't see any reason why copyright law shouldn't apply to the use of a pre-existing work in an NFT. I mean, that is going to be that's going to still be infringement. And it doesn't matter that it's just one, it's a reproduction. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out, because I'm sure there's already court cases about infringement in NFTs. But from where I sit, I don't see any reason why copyright law shouldn't apply in full force.
I just think it's interesting because it's proving, in my eyes at least, from my understanding of the whole process and the whole principle, is that it's an overlap between commercial art and fine art, gallery art, because it's a one-of-a-kind creation, and that's what gives its value to the NFT, is the fact that it's a one-of-a-kind thing. Am I incorrect?
Well, hearing nothing?
I don't know.
Go ahead, Paul.
I don't know, but in that way it would be kind of like a collage if somebody used an image and put it on a collage, but it's digital, so they are still reproducing it.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike a collage where they just cut a picture out of a magazine and glue it onto the canvas. Mm-hmm. Digitally, necessarily they have to reproduce it. So I still think it would be infringement.
We're going to take a quick break here. It's the Copyright Forum. Paul Rapp, Bill Westwood, and Polly Law join us to answer your questions. And if you have one, call us, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Copyright Forum with Ray Graff, and joined today by Polly Law, Paul Rapp, and Bill Westwood. And if you're calling in, just have patience. We're having a couple of phone issues. People are calling in and they're dropping, but hang in there. I think we got it straightened out now. The number once again is 800-348-2551. Meantime, Paul Rapp, how have things been? Now, I haven't talked to too many people who have been across the border since the pandemic.
Yeah, how'd you get there?
They started requiring, and fairly recently, you have to show proof of vaccination, and then you have to show a negative test within 72 hours of you trying to go across the border. And that's kind of dicey, because most of the places that are administering COVID tests tell you that you'll get your results within 5 days. So we went to get our test, and we're like going, it could be that we're going to get in the car and drive to the border and not have our test results yet. And it could be that they'll come in more than 72 hours, in which case, we're stuck in Maine. We have to get another test done.
No problem there.
Luckily ours turned around in about 24 hours. Unfortunately, we had them like on our phones, and we get to the border and there's no phone service and there's no Wi-Fi.
Oh, boy.
The Canadian border guard's going, well, sir, you could get out of your car and just walk around and see if you can catch a signal somewhere.
There you go. Stand up on a phone book. Yeah, there you go. Well, I'm glad you're having fun. Sort of relaxed up there about the are there social distancing protocols, or are people just hanging out in groups?
Yeah, it's more heavy than in the States. We're in Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and now Quebec. Mm-hmm. And most people were wearing masks. We were having restaurants in Quebec asking for proof of vaccination, even though we had, you know, we couldn't have gotten through the border without it. But they were asking for from everybody. And in Nova Scotia, they were doing a contact tracing thing. Everywhere we ate, we had to kind of sign in through into some database that, you know, this phone number was there, so they could contact us if somebody came up sick. So it, it's pretty rigorous.
Well, I'm glad that you made it to this program. It's the Copyright Forum. Paul Rapp is here, Polly Law and Bill Westwood. The number is 800-348-2551. Tom is in Otis. Tom, you're on.
Yeah, my question was about posts on social media. I had posted some stories on Facebook. They have parables of rehabilitation. I'm a psychologist. And Facebook no longer has much written content. So they were short blurbs, and they took them down. I would give out those stories to my patients. I would like, I have them on hard copy. I'd like to print them in a book, since it's not available on any of the social media. It's now all video and images rather than prints. So is it? But Facebook has you sign that you release the rights to publish it when you sign up for Facebook.
All right. Now, Bill Westwood, when was in the green room when I walked in at about 5 of 2 and lamenting about social media. So, Bill, you get the first crack at this one.
Well, I don't do anything on Facebook, partly for all of those reasons. I would, and I suspect Paul would say the same thing, I would want to look at that release and see just how complete that is. I really have never done it. I don't know. Paul, are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I mean, there have been things going around every once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
Hysteria breaks out where people say, you know, Facebook's stealing all my intellectual property. Well, they're not. Their terms of service provide that if you put something up, it could very well get shared. It could go viral. And if you
which
take
is
it
the
down,
point of Facebook.
Right.
Which is the point of Facebook. You're not giving them your intellectual property rights. They're just telling you that your stuff is going to be subject to being shared like crazy. And even if you go later try to take it down, it's already viral.
Yeah.
You know, the toothpaste is out of the tube. But you still retain your intellectual property rights, and you'll still have your copyrights to your works. You know, I would suggest a blog if you want to get your stuff out there, or certainly self-publishing a book. I don't understand Facebook taking down written material.
Yeah, it doesn't stop Heather Cox Richardson from posting very lengthy articles.
Yeah, I mean,
What? I'm sorry.
Wait, they were in the notes section of Facebook, which is like a blog. Nobody reads blogs much anymore. Everybody reads Facebook. And as I said, I'm a psychologist. All my patients were on Facebook. Mm. It was just things for them to access. So I was fine with anybody stealing it, doing whatever they wanted with it. But now they can't get access because Facebook took out the notes section. So
I see.
See. They just made a business decision to stop offering that service. You could put something on Squarespace or on some other on some other platform and merely post links on Facebook for your clients. That would work.
You could also form a Facebook group and have it by invitation only, and you could invite all of your clients to be a part of the group, and that way you could post your longer pieces. And
okay. Well, Tom, thank you very much for the call. It's a Copyright Forum on WAMC. The number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for our panel about intellectual property, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And we have a couple of emails here. Con wrote in, SUNY Geneseo has a T-shirt, crimson, with the Harvard coat of arms. And it says Harvard because everyone can't go to Geneseo. Is that sovereign immunity? And that's from Con.
That's parody.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I don't think that's
sovereign immunity. First of all, Harvard's not
a state
university or a state entity. And second of all, you really can't copyright something on a T-shirt, although there might be some issue with the image that's used with regard to
trademark.
Yeah, it might be a trademark problem. I'm kind of surprised that the college put that out as opposed to, you know, a T-shirt shop at, you know, in Geneseo. I guess it's arguable it's fair use of the trademark, because by its nature, you know, it's not coming from Harvard. It's commenting on Harvard. So
I would assume that any college bookshop that you went to outside of Harvard, you could find a similar T-shirt, but just with the name of the secondary institution swapped out.
This one's from Steve. Copyright of photos of artworks over 100 years old. Steve writes, I'd like to use photos of paintings from museums in a lecture. Volunteer, non-paid. Do I need to take any precautions? Polly.
So long as the works were first published after, I think now it's 1920, or before 1925, it's fair game. So if you're going back 100 years, you know, or more at this point, you're fine using the photographs for any purpose whatsoever, because they'll be in the public domain.
But the artworks may be more than 100 years old, but what if the photographs were taken recently by the Metropolitan Museum of Art? Yeah.
That's an issue if you take it from there.
Well, I mean, there was the case involving what was the photograph database that Microsoft had, and I think it's all now Getty.
Yeah.
Some museums were suing them. The Getty archives would go into the Louvre and set up lights and take like pictures of the works, and people just started, trading them and giving them away and posting them. And they sued, and the court said, no, I mean, there's no creativity here. All you're trying to do is a slavish reproduction of the public domain painting, and that's not the kind of thing copyright protects. And photographers were arguing, well, look, we set up all our lights and we had, all this high-res stuff and this expensive equipment. And none of that matters if there's no creativity. It might be technically amazing what they did, but it's not the kind of creativity that copyright protects. So, the photographs, unless the photographs change the image of the painting dramatically, that change could be protectable. But if it's just a slavish reproduction of the original, then the photographer is not going to get any additional copyright protection.
Okay.
Copyright Forum on WAMC Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question, you can email us as well, voxpop@wamc.org. Jim is in Adams, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on.
Wow. Hang on. Let me take you off speaker. That was a long wait at all.
All right.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, my grandfather was a photojournalist. Up and through till he died in the late 40s. But I have almost scores of original slides, Kodachrome slides. Kodachrome had just come out in 35, and some of these are 36, 37, 38. What is the longevity on copyright original photographic images? I'm thinking that they're probably public domain by now, but these have never been published. No.
Well, was he an employee of a company when he took them?
He was an independent photojournalist and a lecturer. He traveled all over the country doing lectures and slideshows, et cetera. Wow. And he was also a filmmaker. But he was independent.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Paul Rapp.
It would be his life plus 70 years. So when did
he die? He died in, wow, that's it then. He died in 49, 48.
But Paul, was that longevity cycle available in 1949?
No.
No.
I think it was all reconciled with the
did they
with,
go back
with the new trademark law.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it would be the life of the author plus 70.
Okay. He's been gone just over 70.
Now, the other issue though might be, did he assign his copyright to any of those images to any of his clients at the time?
To my knowledge, he never. He had a lot of stuff published in various newspapers, but it would be the same story and the same images in newspapers all over the country.
That's awesome. That's
the only
awesome.
Exception. So as far as the slides are concerned, can I protect them by putting a water, if I want to publish them online, just is a watermark sufficient, or do I have, I mean, does
they're
that
in
even
the
hold,
public domain.
No, yeah, you can.
Yeah, they are in the public domain.
Right.
Okay.
What you could do is if you put them into a book.
Right.
At this point, you probably have the only copies of these that exist.
I do. And these are original Kodachrome. Go ahead.
Yeah, and if you put them into a book, you know, and had some graphic material going along explaining the photographs and all that, you would be able to protect the selection and arrangement of the images, mm-hmm. but, you know, none of the images, individual images themselves, you
Great.
Would be able to protect.
Great. That's pretty much what I was thinking. Thank you so much for your time. I'll let you get on to your next question.
Good luck.
Jim, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Copyright Forum on Vox Pop, and Dakota is in Woodstock. Hello, Dakota.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Here's my question. I hope it falls on, it might not fall under copyright, but I hope it does. All right, so I'm doing a book about Bob Dylan. It's done, and I wanted to know if I can use his name in the title. And another question is, I've illustrated the book with some line drawings because I met him when I was a kid. It's a story about meeting him as a 7-year-old. And I've drawn, can I draw an album cover? You know, just a simple cartoon without being sued and include that in the book if it's an iconic shot. Because I know I could probably draw a picture of Bob Dylan and stick it in the book and if someone couldn't prove. So does that make sense, that question?
No, tell me, what do you mean draw an album cover? I'm sorry, I'm not following that.
Well, I mean, there's like a really iconic album cover of Bob Dylan where you see his head, but maybe if I did a good job with a little very simple line drawing, you'd be like, hey, I know that album and I took that photo.
Yeah, so, that's a derivative work.
Yeah, that's a derivative work.
Yeah,
I think
but
that would
also,
be a problem.
I'd want to see how you use it because I think there's probably a very good fair use argument. You know, you're using this, you know, you're using this not to promote a Bob Dylan album or be the cover of a Bob Dylan album. You're using these things to illustrate your narrative about your relationship with Bob Dylan. And so, yeah, it would be a derivative work, but I think I'd have to look at the context in which it was used. But I think there's a very good fair use argument there, which would mean, you know, you're free
but,
to go.
But I would be cautious. Just because there's a fair use possibility and even a strong one, you don't want to put yourself in a position to get sued by somebody.
Okay.
Would be my concern if I were you.
You'd need to get this cleared by someone first.
And who would that be?
Okay. Well, yeah.
An IP lawyer.
I'll keep this in mind. I'll keep your name. But what about my name, though? I mean, what about the name thing? What do you think about
putting
that?
Putting Dylan in the title?
That's fine. That's fine. Bob Dylan had that song, Gotta Sue Somebody. So.
No, wait a minute, that's wrong.
Gotta Sue Somebody.
That's right.
Also, the other thing I'm going to say, okay, so Melvin Belli, you know him, remember him? I went to his office with this question 30 years ago, and it's come up again that somebody else has my name, Dakota Lane. I mean, yeah. And they're a writer, and I don't, it's not their real name. I don't know who they are, but their book keeps appearing on Amazon under my books. So it looks like, and they're really cheesy romance novels, and they might be doing better than
mine. Oh, come on, fess up, Dakota. You're making a little side money.
You got the Harlequin romance thing going. Good for you. Hey, that's great. Bada bing.
Oh my God, I wish I would just change my name to like China O'Brien or something.
That's nice.
Well,
what do you think?
Yeah, go ahead. Paul, you handle that, and we'll take a break.
In terms of the other person using your name?
Yeah, I don't like it.
Well, I don't think there's a whole lot you can do about it. I mean, I don't think they're intentionally trying to be you. Perhaps you could use your middle initial I would have to look at it, but unless there's some indication that they are willingly trying to deceive the public into thinking they're you, I don't think there's a whole lot you can do about that.
All right. Well, no, Dakota.
But I could probably unhook it. Amazon. Hey, thanks, guys, so much. I really appreciate it. That was really wonderful. Have
really
a wonderful day.
It.
Thanks a lot.
Good luck with the new book. And I hate to break the news to you, Dakota, a couple states also using your name. And it's, you know, let's take a quick break here. 800-348-2551. Paul Rapp, Bill Westwood, Polly Law, join us today on the Copyright Forum. More of your calls coming up. Lovely, lovely. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 2:41 is the time. The Copyright Forum in full swing here with Polly Law, Bill Westwood, and the international traveler, Paul Rapp. This email came in from Kim in, I believe, Greenwich. It might be Greenwich. It doesn't say the state. Kim writes, I have heard that you can't patent or copyright a hole shape. Hence the seemingly free exchange of molds between manufacturers of racing boats. Is this true? And if so, why is there a carve-out for boats?
I don't think there's a carve-out for boats. There are some big issues with being able to copyright, like, house plans and things like that.
Yeah, utilitarian objects.
Paul.
Yeah, there is a carve out for boats. If you look at the Copyright Act, for whatever reason, and I think it all has to do with money and Congress, there's a whole section about boats.
What?
And yeah.
Now, how old is that law, Paul? Because maybe at that time, boats were the fastest form of transportation. Maybe they should amend this for cars and everything else.
No, I just think it's probably a senator from a coastal
Rhode Island. As the caller implied, it has to do with racing boats. And, you know, being based, you know, here in upstate New York and before that in the Berkshires, I never had a racing boat designer come to me with an issue. So I don't really know anything
okay.
about the law. But I do know that there is, it's like a racing boat exception. And it's just one of those, you know, weird things where some lobbyists get to Congress and get this law passed. You know, and what I know, I'm not a patent lawyer, but what I know about it is I don't see any reason why a boat design, an innovative boat design, would not be patentable. But that's a whole topic. I think if you want answers, just get on the internet and,
okay.
You know, it's as obscure a part of copyright law as there could ever possibly be.
All right. I think it's the first time it's come up on this program.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That and the deer hoof rattle is, you know, kind of watermark, you know, watershed events for us.
All right, quickly, yeah. One email here, one more, and then we'll go back to the phones. This one's from Diane. And Diane's subject heading, photos of people seen in public. And we've covered this. Diane writes, I'd like to make games using photographs I've taken of people and places. For example, I have photos of people at the Albany Tulip Fest and of children dancing at music festivals. In some photos, you can clearly see faces. Is it okay to use these types of photos? I hope to produce these games and sell them. And that's from Diane.
No, it's... You know, you can publish pictures of people that are out in public because, as a matter of privacy law, they don't have an expectation of privacy if they're out walking on the street. However, once you start slapping their faces on articles of commerce, that runs afoul of New York State's privacy law that says you can't use the name or the likeness or, you know, the signature of anyone on an article of commerce or in advertising, you know, without their permission.
But newspapers are sold. That is commerce. Why then can a photographer who makes money taking a picture of, say, an event downtown with people in it, not have to pay those people to be in the photo?
That's the fair use exception.
Well, it's because that's not considered, just because it's on an article that's making some money. That doesn't necessarily make it an article of commerce, but game pieces or putting them on a T-shirt or putting them on, the cover of a Wheaties box.
Advertising.
That gets closer to advertising, and that kind of article of commerce is what is, what's not allowed.
Now, if Bill Westwood had to draw my liver, would he have to pay me for that?
You'd have to pay him.
Yeah, yeah. Good luck. Trust
me.
Good luck with that one, brother. All right, let's go to the phones. Rob in Turner's Falls. Rob, you're on.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am wondering if somebody were to have a good idea for a story and or a title, would there be a way to protect that in advance, like perhaps by writing a short story, and then could that later be replaced by a full book?
Well, that's what's called a treatment. And you could write a treatment. You could write a treatment. You could write a few sample chapters of your proposed book. You can then, if you want to, go the route of registering that piece, and that would protect that. You cannot copyright a title, but... you can,
and you can't trademark a title either.
Yeah, but you can register a sample of the piece if you're the author.
I think it has to be sufficiently detailed that when you do the full blown book, it can honestly be, it meets the sniff test of being a derivative work of your shorter work. But really, I mean, if you have an idea for a book,
just write the book.
Write the book and write, if you're going to do a short version and register that because you're afraid that, somebody's going to find out about it and beat you to it, just make sure that your treatment, your short version, is quite elaborate in terms of names and places and plot and, story arc and all of that kind of stuff. Because then your full book will be a true derivative work based on the first, and that will be protected as well.
Yes, but that wouldn't protect the title.
You can't protect the title, really.
Uh-uh. I don't get that.
Titles are not protectable.
Really? Under any law.
So I could come up with a book that's called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and it would be fine.
As long as it doesn't infringe on the content of Douglas Adams' book, you're fine.
That is crazy.
If it's about your experiences in your backyard, you're golden.
Well, actually, that is such an iconic book that it could be argued, and believe me, the publisher will argue that you were trying to deceive the public, and, that's not copyright or trademark, that's the deceptive business practice. Uh-huh. If they're saying you only used the title of this deceptive book to deceive the public, then that would be a deceptive business practice. And when you get a book that's as iconic as that, it's hard to argue that you weren't trying to deceive the public,
Well, okay. Back to the phones we go. Joan in Greenwich, New York. Hello, Joan.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello?
Hi. Hello. You're on.
Hi. I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Hello.
I'm going to turn the volume of my phone up. Okay.
Fair enough.
You can hear me, though.
Sure, yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Okay, my husband and I are songwriters, and our most recent song is about the ghost of a famous folk singer / songwriter who is now deceased, and in the song he visits the narrator of the song, and there are some direct quotes as part of telling the story. There's nothing really negative about this person in the song, and I'm just wanting to make sure that we don't get in trouble in case the song ever gets out there with this person's estate.
Mm.
How long has this person been a how long has this person been a ghost?
A few years or so. I'm not sure. I'd have to look.
Fairly recently, though.
Yes, not somebody like in the 20s or 30s. Somebody, you know, probably not more than 5 years ago.
But you can't mention this person in a song. I don't get it, Paul.
I think
no, you can. You can, and you know, unless you're taking like whole verses or whole choruses or whole chunks of the melody, I'm going to say that sounds like classic fair use,
right?
Because you're telling a story, you know, about this this singer songwriter.
And as long as it's not slanderous.
No,
yeah,
it's,
and even then,
it's
I mean,
the
person's dead. The person's dead, so you can probably slander them all you want. You know, you don't want to.
Well, there's an attorney
well, we
speaking
to you. You know, we thought that we could say, you know, I dreamed that the ghost of so-and-so came to see me. But it just takes all the punch out of the story to do that.
Right.
Interesting.
It sounds to me like it'd be perfectly fine in terms of fair use. I mean, I can't guarantee that because I haven't heard the song and analyzed it, but it sure sounds like it to me because people do that all the time and they write about iconic people.
It does mention a song title of his, but it's a common word and it's a one word thing.
Well,
so
now we're all
get in trouble for
all wondering who it is. It's got to be Burl Ives or Boxcar Willie, right?
Not quite. A little more recent than that.
Okay.
And we were, just tangentially, but we've met another quite famous singer, and we were thinking of sending it to him because he liked the other, he liked the CD of ours that we sent him.
Cool.
And also there was another very famous person who is still alive and was a good friend of this person's, I'm not sure we could get it to this person, but we thought we might try.
This is all very mysterious,
and
Joan.
I just wanted to make sure that in case anyone actually liked it, we were not going to end up in court.
Okay. Well, if you do, you know, Paul handles that sort of thing, and he's the one who said, by the way, go ahead and do it. So good luck, and I hope the song works out for you. Let's go now to Paula in Clifton Park. Paula.
Yes, I wanted to find out. I want to write a book, publish a book with quotes in it, and it's all people who are deceased. Is there a length of time that they have to be gone in order to publish them?
If it's just one or two lines?
Yes.
No, that's classic fair use.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's famous quote sites all over the internet with, you know, one or two sentence long quotes of famous people live and dead. And that's, and the site didn't run around getting permission. You know, the quotes are certainly usable. And, you know, in a book where you're using quotes, I think it's generally going to be fair use every single time, unless you go on and on for pages with a quote, and then you may have issues.
All right, Paula, thanks a lot. Good luck with that book of yours. And we've had a couple of people write in about the boat holes. Here we go. I'm not kidding you. So Alexandria writes in, the hull of boats is integral to how it travels through the water. Just like a medication that costs millions to develop or the recipe for Coke, I believe it's considered a trade secret. And extreme lengths are taken to protect it. Paul Rapp.
Hello. Paul,
I would agree, that we're talking about boat hulls, but yeah, I would agree. These things are, probably kept under wraps in terms of the exact dimensions. But then again, I don't see why a lot of these things would not be patentable.
Okay,
but then again, there's the special weird protection under the copyright law that I don't know anything about, but I know
boat exemption. Now, let's go back to Coca-Cola that Alexandria mentioned. If I were a corporate spy and somehow I got that secret recipe, or I stole Colonel Sanders' recipe of secret herbs and spices, they're just herbs and spices. I can use them, right?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why they're held in vaults.
unless you got them knowingly from someone who was under, you know, a confidentiality agreement.
Right. Well, that's point, their problem. You
know, or broke into the safe.
Yeah.
That's a different story.
Like if I reverse engineered a piece of Colonel Sanders' chicken, I could pull this off. Let's go to Albrecht.
Absolutely.
And Rhinebeck, you're on.
Love your etchings, by the way.
Go ahead.
This is Albrecht from Rhinebeck, Morehouse Farm, Marinos.
Yeah.
I'm calling about my late wife was a knitwear designer for our own wool. And she saw that book, Nano Photos, that inspired her for designs of scarves. So on the website, she used a small, like postage stamp size photo to explain what inspired her for the scarves, which were next to it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we sold were the scarves, not anything else. And she thought at that time, that was my understanding, that that was under fair use protected. She also listed the source, the name of the book and the publisher's name. And she assumed that it was fair use. Mm. Now I got calls from lawyers that I owe a bunch of money for infringement of, copyright.
Okay.
So I'm not sure whether that was fair use or not.
Well, there are people who go around and look at websites and just send out these kind of infringement letters right and left in hopes that someone will pay up. Go ahead.
I would strongly advise you to meet with a copyright attorney and get some sound legal advice in terms of whether or not this was fair use, because this is serious business and people can go after you for a lot of money if you don't have adequate representation.
Good advice.
Yeah, I've been inundated with people getting nasty grams from copyright trolls.
Yeah.
There's a couple of firms that are doing a lot of it, and they seem to be accelerating. And most of them will very rarely sue.
Has that changed, Paul, since the small claims court sort of thing happened?
It hasn't happened yet.
They're still setting it up. And so it hasn't gone live yet. It's getting closer and closer. I don't expect it to change because you have to agree to be part of a defendant in the copyright small claims action that for the people listening, you know, Congress authorized 2 years ago that there would be a special little small claims court that would all be done over the internet for small scale infringements. And that hasn't started yet, but like I said, you have to agree to be part of that process. And so I don't think, I think it's just going to be a non-starter.
Well, this was a perfect way to end with a non-starter. Paul Rapp, thanks for being here, man. Have fun up there in Canada. I hope you make it back across.
I'm going to go have some snails. We'll see ya.
All right. Fair enough. Polly Law, thank you for being thank you for being here, Polly. You going to have some snails?
No, I'm not going to have any snails. Thank you very much.
How about you, Bill Westwood?
I'm going back to work. I don't know what you guys are up to.
Yeah, I guess I'll do the same. Hey, thank you all for being here. Support comes from Agricultural Stewardship Association, presenting their 20th annual Landscapes for Land's Sake art exhibit benefiting farmland protection October 9th to October 30th. Landscapesforlandsake.com. And Ambrose Electric Standby Power, an electrical contractor providing sales service at installation of residential and commercial Generac automatic standby generators serving the Greater Capital District for over 40 years, AmbroseLEC.com. Once again, thanks to Bill Westwood, Polly Law, and Paul Rapp for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for all the questions about boats. I learned a lot today about hulls. I hope you did as well. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. He's been steering the ship. Amber Sickles screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. And you know what? Tomorrow, we have a very smart bunch here. It's going to be the Science Forum. So if you have a question about hanging clothing out on the line or how You know, does cold water freeze faster than hot water? It's tomorrow at 2, the Science Forum. It's exciting, theoretically. Stand by now for 51%.